You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Yes. And I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and wonderful mother, Caroline Kilbourne.
Well, thank you. It's a beautiful day, and it's great because it's raining south of us really hard and going to be flooding down there, so we're most fortunate here.
All right. I don't know. I'm not sure your volume is too good. Try again, Mom.
Okay. No?
Yeah, there's...
The volume.
Here we go.
She taps it, and it's on. Okay. Okay, and once again, it's a beautiful day.
It is a beautiful day. And we have a double-decker show today. We have two amazing books, each of which would deserve an hour of their own.
Absolutely.
And we're having to squeeze them both into half an hour. So who do we have up first, Mom?
Well, first we have, the book is called An Atlas of Countries That Don't Exist. And it's fantastic. Nick Middleton is the researcher of all this, and I don't know how in the world he did it. But it's a fascinating, fascinating book because these countries have been and gone, and some of them not that long ago. You think, oh, well, you know, in the past, but no. So anyway, okay, something about him. He's a geographer, writer, and presenter of television documentaries. I can believe that. He teaches at Oxford University, where he is a fellow of St. Anne's College. A Royal Geographical Society award-winning author, he works, teaches, and communicates on a wide variety of geographical travel and environmental issues for a broad range of audiences, from policymakers to primary school children. And this book is fascinating.
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Nick.
Hello, nice to be with you.
Okay, I'm going to hold you as close. We also had some technical difficulties. Well, on Nick's end, his phone went out, and so we're trying to do this via Skype. And okay,
oh, gosh.
So tell us, Nick, what gave you the idea to write this book?
A couple of inspirations. A few years ago, 3 years ago, I was reading an English classic of children's literature to my then 7-year-old daughter, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which all takes place in an imaginary land behind the back of a wardrobe in an English country house. And we both really enjoyed the story, and it got me thinking about countries that might be unnoticed in some way. And then a few months later, I met someone from the Isle of Man, which is a small island between England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. And it's an oddity because in many ways it's an independent nation because they issue their own passports, they make their own laws, they raise their own taxes, and yet their foreign policy and defence are run from Westminster here in UK. And when I looked into the Isle of Man, it turns out that they have the world's oldest continuously operating parliament, going back to the 8th century.
Oh my goodness.
So they've been running their own affairs very early, ever since, and yet they're sort of under the umbrella of the UK, but they're not a member of the UK, they're not a member of the European Union. And once I started digging into these sort of other types of place, I was amazed at how many there are out there. And there are 50 countries that don't exist.
And did you... What was the criteria that you actually used for inclusion in this book? Hello?
Oh, did we lose him?
I don't know. Nick, are you there? All right, we're going to try this again. And in the meantime, Mom, why don't you talk a little bit about some of the countries
okay,
that are in there?
This one is interesting. You know, I started out and I thought, well, this is interesting. Well, the next one, well, that's interesting. The next one, yeah, that's interesting too. It just kept going. But this one was the Cyprus. Now, Cyprus is off the coast of Syria. It's south of Turkey. It's in the Mediterranean Sea, and it was once a great resort. I mean, a tremendous resort area. But then something happened, and it got, The Turkish soldiers approached. Residents of this Greek Cypriot seaside town fled in their bell-bottom trousers, hastily packed bags under their arms. And then they left behind a thriving Mediterranean resort, the best beach on Cyprus, a glitzy playground for the rich and famous. After years of feuding between the island's two communities led to a coup that, inspired by Greece's ruling military junta, Turkish troops occupied the northeastern part of the island. One side talked of liberation by Turkey, the other called it an invasion. I mean, it was one of those deals where, you know, and now now the resort just lies there. There's nothing, you know, nothing going on.
All right, I think we've got Nick back. Are you with us?
Nope.
Hello, are you there?
I am with you. I can hear you, Ben.
Okay, all right. I don't know.
Lots of these would-be countries out there. This book has 50 of them. I could have filled it several times over.
Really?
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. So what criteria did you use to decide what to include?
So they all have a permanent population, some form of government, a claim to territory.
Oh, no, we lost him again. For some reason, it's cutting out. Can you hear us?
Okay, let's talk about Lakota. Now, Lakota is...
Light country, yeah, there,
there
you
he
are.
Is.
Just up the road from you guys. It's a sorry tale of the Lakota Sioux, who signed a treaty with your government in the 1860s, which under the treaty it gave them all rights to their traditional lands, which are the Black Hills.
Mm-hmm.
But sadly, Goldwyn discovered them, their hills, a few years later, and all bets were off.
Yeah.
But the Lakota, because the Black Hills are a sacred territory to these people, they fought for it, and both on the battlefield and subsequently in the law courts, and they were awarded compensation backdated to 1868. It's now worth more than $500 million.
Wow. Yeah,
they won't take it. They let their land back, please. Sadly, they're not going to get it.
Wow. So we are having a little bit of technical difficulty, and so most of that we could hear, but so they've been offered, or they won compensation for the land, but they won't take it. Wow.
No, so...
Yeah, that's right. They won't take it because they say, well, we'll just have our land back. Thank you very much. You stole it. It wasn't for sale. So give us our land back. Needless to say that the U.S. government hasn't given them their land back, and they actually unilaterally withdrew from the treaty as well in 2000 with U.S. sovereignty. So it's a large slab of the United States of America.
Wow.
And these people could do with the money because they're very much so. That land was not for sale.
Whoa.
Yeah, they...
Quite a number of these... examples are sad in that sort of sense. There's small groups of people who are being bullied by larger groups and nation state government. Not all, but many of them are quite sad stories, I fear. Mm-hmm. Some of them are a bit mad. Some of them are downright bizarre. It's a whole collection.
All right. Well, give me an example of one that you would consider a bit mad.
Well, there's an island in the Caribbean not that far from here called Redonda, which was first discovered by Christopher Columbus. It's not a very big island, and first sighted in the 15th century. Anyway, no one lived there, and a trader from nearby Montserrat decided that he was going to own this island because it was up for grabs, as it were. And he declared himself to be the king of Redonda. He passed on his crown to his son, who actually was a
Oh. All right, we lost audio there for a moment, but I think he'll be back. There we go. So, Nick, we couldn't hear from the point where you said he passed it on to his son. You want to pick up there?
Okay, yes. His son was quite a well-known fictional writer and made a fair amount of money. Decided he didn't want to live in the Caribbean, if you can believe such a thing. So he moved to England. And when he one of his best-known works was called The Purple Cloud, which was filmed in Hollywood, a film called The World, the Flesh, and the Devil, starred Harry Belafonte.
Whoa.
Hollywood B-movie. Anyway, this guy, M.P. Scheel, passed on his crown to his literary executor, who was a pretty poor poet. Poor, both not a very good poet, but also economically poor. And this guy started selling aristocratic titles from a pub in North London, if you believe such things.
That's pretty clever.
To the extent whereby now Redonda still has a resident population of zero, but there are no fewer than 9 kings who all claim the throne to Redonda.
Wow!
And some of them issue postage stamps. They all have flags. Some of them issue their own currency, but no one lives on Redonda.
Okay, so what?
It's one of those.
Oh, dear.
I guess it's just bragging rights they get, huh?
Yeah, not far off. Well, they get to call themselves king, which is there's a certain ring to it.
Well, now, it would have made more sense to just sell off dukedoms, right?
Yeah. Oh, he did that too. He did the whole dukedoms, all sorts of noble titles to senior celebrities of the day, people like Dorothy Sayers, who was a famous fictional writer, Henry Miller, Dylan Thomas, J.B. Priestley. They were all given noble titles. And there was a story that actually, if you found this guy, his name was John Gawsworth, a very minor poet. If you bought him a drink at the Alma Tavern in Westbourne Grove in North London, at lunchtime, he'd give you an aristocratic title written on the back of a beer mat.
Wow.
How did you find out about that?
How did I find out?
Yes, how did you find out about that?
The Redonda example I found in an academic paper about sovereignty. I've used all sorts of sources for this book. So some academic papers, some books, old newsreels. Some of these more contemporary examples have their own websites. I've used oral histories, you name it. I've used all sorts of sources to gather together the information for this book.
It's amazing.
How long did it take you to gather all that information?
I suppose once I started seriously doing it, about 4, 5, 6 months.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
And that was full time? You were working on it full time?
No, not far off full time, I suppose.
Wow.
Probably 4 months. 4 months full time. Because I also had to brief the designer to draw the maps. And I expect if you've seen a copy of the book,
we do.
It's beautifully designed.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it is. Fascinating.
So shall I just describe it briefly for listeners?
Yes, please.
So each non-country has 4 pages, and you have the first 2 pages with the name and a few details like the capital and the population. And then the right-hand page, as you look at it, has a hole in it, a cutout, in the shape of the non-country. And so you can see it, and you think, well, what's that then? Because it's not a very familiar shape. And it's a tease, because once you turn over, you then see the outline of this country surrounded by countries, the names of which you probably do know, so you see it in context. So that's the whole idea of this, is that we're all familiar with the political map of the world, which shows every square inch of the world's land surface carved up between countries, but there are all these other shadowy countries that never get a look in, which are there, but you're not supposed
to. Nick, do you think that any of the countries in this book will someday become recognized and take their place as nations?
That's a key question, isn't it? And I think of all of them,
most likely is Greenland.
Yes, I was just going to talk about that a minute. That's, you know, we think of Greenland as being a country.
Well, it's been a Danish colony. It's officially it's part of Denmark.
Oh,
for nearly 300 years. But the Danes in recent times have been ceding a bit of the power, and they've got Greenland got home rule in 1979 and then self-rule in 2009. They all get a bit more self-governance. And many people believe that Greenland is on course. The next stop is full independence.
Mm.
And there's a key date coming up. 2021 is the 300th anniversary of Danish colonial rule. And that would be an extremely auspicious year in which to give full sovereignty back to Greenland.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, I guess we don't realize how many countries own other bits of land, you know, that they colonized.
No, there you are.
Yeah.
Another thing that's fascinating to me is how much the political map has changed in my lifetime.
Yeah, exactly so. I mean, you think about it, those of your listeners who remember the Soviet Union as was,
right.
Which isn't that long ago.
No.
You know, when it disintegrated, it created 15 new countries.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go, 1990s was a real phase. So some countries broke into, Czechoslovakia became Czech Republic and Slovakia. Ethiopia lost the Red Sea coast to Eritrea. And then, conversely, other countries became reunited. East and West Germany became one in 1990. Likewise, North and South Yemen got together. But there have been many more new countries in the last 50 years or so than there have countries being lost. And so in this century, we've had East Timor, Montenegro, South Sudan. So you're right, there's been a definite trend towards more fragmentation in recent years.
I had a friend who told me she was going on a trip to Montenegro, and I'm like, that's a country? I had no idea.
Yeah, there you are. They're out there, these places.
Yeah.
And many of them have got sort of degrees of recognition. Recognition by other countries is like a gold standard. That's what they all want, to the extent whereby some non-countries have set up their own, like, equivalents the United Nations, the UN, which is the unrepresented United Nations.
So there's
has about 30 members.
There's a United Nations of non-nations.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, sir. Exactly.
Wow.
You know, we hear a lot about the Crimea, and that's one of these countries that you have here. And there's two million people population. So, you know, that's... quite a bit.
Yeah,
some of them are small territory terms that are so in population.
In a country like that, or a non-country like that, how, you know, were you familiar with kind of the history of those sort of things before you started, or did you really learn a lot?
Yeah, in many cases, I'm a geographer, it sort of is my business, but yes, in many cases I was aware of the history of Crimea, for example, which is one of those situations where, this is quite a common tactic, a big country decides it wants a bit of territory, so it moves out the indigenous population. So in the case of Crimea, Stalin deported most of the Crimean Tatars in the early 20th century, and flooded the place with Russians.
Mm.
Likewise, Western Sahara, the Moroccans. You know, it's a classic tactic. So yes, in many cases, I was aware of the history, but there are other places that are in this book that I was unfamiliar with, so I learned material too.
So are some of the countries in here, the population of that country isn't actually living in the geographic location that they're claiming as their country?
Yeah, in the case of Western Sahara, that is definitely the case. Western Sahara is an old Spanish colony in West Africa, and most of its population lives in refugee camps in Algeria, the neighboring country. because they've been cleared out by the Moroccans, who occupied it after the Spanish left. And the reason is, and again, this is quite a common situation, the reason is it's full of things other people want, in this case, phosphates, which were very widely used for agriculture, and rich fishing grounds offshore. So virtually the entire indigenous population lives outside its territory.
Mm. I wonder at what point people decide that where they came from or where their ancestors came from isn't home anymore, and where they are now becomes home in those kind of situations, in a refugee situation. Sometimes we think, well, wouldn't it be nice if everybody got their country back? But it would be an unending, game, wouldn't it?
That's what a lot of the established countries are afraid of. That's why they won't readily recognize many of these non-countries. Because you're right, it's a so-called floodgates argument. Once you recognize one, there'll be a flood of others. And in many cases, there are very strong arguments in favor of recognizing some of these non-countries. But that's what holds back the more established countries from recognizing them, because they're afraid of where it's going to stop.
Mm. In the case of Taiwan, that, of course, was Second World War. There was the Chinese nationalists lost the Civil War and fled to the mainland, and they took up residence on the island of, that is Taiwan, as Republic of China. And they are both part of the same country, and the country is China. But how that works with two separate governments, one in Beijing and another in Taipei, or P, I don't know how you pronounce that. They call it the two China problem. So it's been going on for a long time. And that,
too right, it has. Many decades. And everyone just pretends that there's one China. But of course, in reality, there are two, as you say. There's mainland China and there's Taiwan. But it's quite an interesting example, because one might think that, you think to yourself, well, what is a country? You might think that if you're a member of the United Nations, that's it. It's the gold standard, because it's a club that's only for sovereign states. And yet Taiwan's a very interesting example, because it was a member of the United Nations until the early 70s, and then it was kicked out. So there's only one Chinese seat in the United Nations. Taiwan had it, and then all the other countries said, oh, well, actually, sorry, we're going to give it to mainland China now. So Taiwan has this strange characteristic of being recognized by very few countries, including your own. The US doesn't recognize Taiwan as a country, neither does the UK. And yet, in practice, it behaves like a country. It's got its own government, a democratically elected government. It's a rather large economy. It's a really strange, strange thing. Once you start digging, I've been fascinated by the fact that there's no one universally accepted definition of a country. And when you start any of the criteria that you try and use, there are always exceptions and anomalies. And you're quite right. Taiwan is one of those.
And it would seem like such a simple thing, what a country is.
It should be. But it's not.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Nick Middleton, and the author of An Atlas of Countries That Don't Exist, a compendium of 50 unrecognized and largely unnoticed states. Of course, Taiwan isn't one of the unnoticed ones, but a lot of them are things that you have never heard of. And this is published by Chronicle Books, which is one of our favorite publishers. They do such an amazing job, don't they?
They do. It's a beautiful book.
It is. I want to ask you, do you have plans to write, to do more research and write, or use research you've already done and write another book?
I've written many books. This is just about my 20th odd book. yes, there are other books in the pipeline. Many of them are ideas in my head. I haven't started writing a new one yet, but there are a couple of ideas that will see the light of day not too far off, distantly in the future.
Now, I know that some of our Chronicle Book authors that are from the UK had published with a different publisher in the UK and then in the US with Chronicle. Is that how you did it?
Yes, no, Chronicle have bought the U.S., the North right. American rights
right.
to the book that was published a couple of years ago here in the U.K. by Macmillan. But that's the way the publishing industry works.
Right,
You sell foreign rights.
And does the book look the same, or does it look completely different in the U.S. version?
Very, very similar, very similar.
Very similar.
Well, see, what I like about this is on this front page, it tells you the capital, the population, and the area that it occupies, where it is, and the language it's spoken there, which I think is, you know, you can get a lot of history in a very small space there.
Exactly so. And then you flip over and you see it on a map in context, and there's a little story, a sort of vignette
yes.
from its history.
Right.
Well, Nick, in the few minutes we have left, would you like to read one of the vignettes for us?
Yes. Do you want to choose one, or shall I just...
You go ahead.
Whatever
comes to mind.
Okay, here we go. This is about Tibet, a non-country that you probably know about.
Yes, yes, I was wondering about that.
Nobody crossed the mountain pass in winter. The snow was too deep. But this was an emergency, so every man and woman in the village worked through the night to clear the way for his escape route. It was March, the third Tibetan lunar month, 1959. His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, had left Lhasa in secret more than a week earlier. As the Chinese People's Liberation Army began firing artillery shells at his palace, he rode away on a horse under cover of darkness. China's official explanation was that he had been kidnapped by bandits. Following a course prescribed by an oracle, His Holiness arrived in the village of Sona, dressed in a brown knitted cap and wearing dark glasses against the snow glare. He spent the night in the village monastery, where strings of coloured prayer flags stretched from the compound's mud walls up to the biscuit-coloured cliffs behind. He conducted evening prayers and meditation among the flickering yak butter lamps and old silk wall hangings, while outside, high in the pass, the villagers stamped the snow down so the horses could cross. A half moon was floating in a perfect blue sky when he departed the next morning, the residents of Sonas following his entourage saying prayers as they went. The perpetual parade moved in a constant hum generated by the muttering of mantras. People living along the wayside emerged from their homes to make prostrations as the horses struggled past. The route over the Himalayan mountains was precipitous and rocky, slippery and dangerous. Over the pass, down through a forest and beyond, the spiritual leader of Tibet was offered asylum in India. The Dalai Lama settled in the history of in the city of Dharamsala, he and his followers moulding an area now known as Little Lhasa, and so began more than half a century of exile.
Oh, boy. So how do we get your book? How can we get your book?
Yeah, you buy it in a bookshop, maybe.
Okay. That's what I want to know.
Definitely. Bookshop is one place. I'm sure you can get it on the internet. It's called An Atlas of Countries That Don't Exist. I am Nick Middleton. The book is published in the U.S. by Chronicle Books.
It's a wonderful book.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Nick. We've really...
Not at all. Glad we overcame those
things. Yeah, me too. Thank goodness for Skype.
Exactly so.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's take a brief musical break here, and we'll get our second guest on the line. Thank you. right, we're back on Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is, again, my mother, Caroline Kilborn. And our next book is kind of on a similar theme. We're talking geography.
Yeah, it's an amazing book. It truly is.
Who do we have with us?
We have Hugh Lewis Jones, he's going to be talking to us, but there was another person involved in this, and it was Carrie Herbert.
Which is his wife.
Okay. So this book is, as I say, is amazing. There's so many illustrations in it, and I'm just very curious as to how you found all these.
It's called Explorer Sketchbooks, The Art of Discovery and Adventure. So, Hugh, are you an explorer?
No, absolutely not.
Well, then
you
what
could have fooled me.
Yeah, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I should just say I'm so sorry that my wife's not able to join us. She's the co-author of this book, and her late father was a true explorer, a man called Sir Wally Herbert. I'm a polar guide, I'm a historian, I've always enjoyed these kind of tales of explorers, so that was one of the major motivations in creating a book like this. The other is just really to have the chance of sharing some stories of people who we actually don't know a great deal about. And opening Explorer's Sketchbooks allows us to jump into these, right into the heart of some great adventures.
Well, I would say as a polar guide, that's pretty adventurous to me.
Okay, well, I mean, I think for those true explorers, the explorer is kind of a precious term, if you like. There's plenty of adventurers these days doing all things and calling it exploration, but all of the men and women in this book I think of as true explorers, but there's a whole range of people, of course, men and women, as I've said, polar explorers, jungle explorers, botanists, anthropologists, travelers, writers, scientists, all manner of people going out into the world with open eyes.
And this book is just full of illustrations right from the Explorer sketchbooks. So you do write about them, and but the bulk of the book is really is the Explorer's own words or images.
That's right. It's kind of a tricky book maybe to explain on radio because it's very, very visual. It's really a big coffee table book. A friend's joke that I'm always making these books that people like to put their feet up on that deserve to be out and displayed and enjoyed and returned to. In actual fact, I'm a museum curator as much as a writer or historian, and to create a book like this was a chance of making an exhibition that you really couldn't do in a real museum, if you like, because these artifacts, these journals and sketchbooks are spread all over the world and in very obscure collections, often family collections, private archives. And so bringing them together in a book was, yes, a chance to tell a story, but also just a chance to really enjoy some beautiful images.
Well, I imagine it was quite a challenge to get all these, to find out where all these were and you know.
Well, I mean, that's part of it. I mean, exploration almost in and of itself, a bit like a treasure hunt, I guess.
Yeah.
I've written a whole load of exploration books, so I kind of knew where to begin. I had, a working list of explorers that I admired. But like anything, and I say this a lot to people, to students too, is the more you read, the more you realize that you need to read more books, the less you know. And it's the same a little with this book. We started off with a whole bunch of figures that we wanted to learn more about, but then at each step of the process we were finding new figures and new individuals and new archives, and it's almost endless. So the challenge really is to decide what to leave out.
Do you have enough material for another book?
Oh, there's another 5, 6, 7 books, I think. Not necessarily on this kind of theme. I'm a visual historian, so I write books about exploration history, but it was really absolutely our intention with this book to be able to jump all over the place in terms of over time and space, so you can flick through this book and join explorers deep in dense jungles, turn a page, you're out on an iceberg, turn another page, you're climbing Everest, another page, you're discovering a new type of beetle or bug, turn another page and you're down to the bottom of the sea floor, or another, and you know, you're again back to the jungles and finding new kinds of wildlife. So, I mean, that was the joy of it really for me, is to try and take us on all sorts of curious journeys through the journals that survive these explorers.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the organization of the book, because, you know, you could have organized chronologically, you could have organized by type of exploration, you know, Arctic versus jungle, or by continent, but instead you did it alphabetically by the name of...
Sounds a bit sort of straightforward, that, doesn't it? It's peculiar. When you start any book, I mean, the big challenge is trying to wrestle all of the possibilities into something that's manageable. How to, you know, eat an elephant. You've got to start with small mouthfuls. I would never eat an elephant, I should say. point is this: you have to try and make a mass of information manageable. So there's 500 years worth of exploration history. How to arrange it? We could have done it by region, I guess. You know, the polar region, the jungles, the deserts, and the mountains. And I have arranged other books a bit like that. You know, one of the challenges with doing that is that there are so many explorers who actually travel all over the place. So where do you put someone like Captain Cook, who, you know, famously crosses the Antarctic Circle for the first time, but was also probably more well known for his discoveries in the Pacific, or other explorers who both climb mountains and cross continents, or spend time in deep jungles on one continent and then explore deserts on another. So we quickly decided against that. Alphabetic was the way to do it, in my mind, because it forces some kind of structure on you that makes it easy to follow. But at the same time, you get these really lovely, I would say, sort of serendipitous contrasts between explorers. So as I said, one minute you could be, I don't know, sitting with Charles Darwin in his study, turn a few pages and you're climbing Everest, turn a few more pages and you jump back 300 years and you're you know, looking for plant species in a jungle. Turn another page and you're back out on the ice or up a mountain. So for me, that serendipity, that back and forth, enabled kind of interesting contrast in content, weird juxtapositions actually, but I think can help us find some similarities and you know, shared moments across the ages. What is it that makes an explorer? What did these men and women have in common, if anything at all, and what might their stories tell us today?
But sprinkled throughout, there's a handful that are not in alphabetical order, and it looks to me like those are the still living explorers.
That's right. I mean, I'm pleased. It sounds like you've read this book. It's a forensic analysis.
Yes.
Of a book. I tell you what, one of the reasons for this was, as a historian, one of the frustrations you find, I suppose in some ways it makes life easy sometimes, is that you can never meet and talk to the people you're writing about. That goes with the territory, being a historian. However, with exploration, there are many men and women who are working today who I still think of as explorers. And so the book has this A to Z of great names from the past, but sprinkled within it, we're better to learn about exploration from explorers themselves who are with us. And so we have essays sown throughout by people who are doing interesting things. I think of Wade Davis, a pretty well-known Amazonian ethnobotanist. We've got the world's leading penguin expert, a traveling artist, even an astronaut, Alan Bean, one of the amazing moonwalkers in the Apollo missions, an artist too. So to have someone like Alan writing for this book and sharing some of his experiences, some of the wonders that he's seen and then has translated into artworks, that was, you know, just what a privilege to be able to talk to someone like that. So he's wedged in the book between Alexander von Humboldt, a very well-known Prussian jungle explorer, geographer, and Meriwether Lewis, probably, I don't know, arguably one of the most famous American explorers, Lewis
Absolutely.
And Clark.
Yeah. Yes.
Journey up the Missouri River in 1804-05, which, of course, is taught in your schools, I guess, I hope.
Yes,
I
it hope is. So. Yeah, or at least it so was too. Back when we were in school, but who knows now?
Yeah, who knows?
Well, but that's another kind of interesting thing. Each country has its own heroes or its explorers. You know, in Britain, it's the likes of sort of Captain Cook or Captain Scott, a polar explorer, whereas I guess in America, if you asked anyone to name an explorer, perhaps today they'd name Shackleton, if anyone at all. So, and I should say all of these explorers are in the book and more. So that's one of the real interests. The other, of course, as you said, right at the top of the piece is my co-author, my wife, very lucky to say, Kari Herbert, and her late father, Sir Wally, was a polar explorer in the sort of traditional mold. He charted, you know, many thousand square miles in Antarctica as a surveyor. He made a great journey across the Arctic Ocean in the 1960s with just sledges, fur clothes and dogs, you know, a journey really in the spirit of those made in the past, the first time and the only time that anyone has crossed from Alaska through the North Pole all the way across the Arctic Ocean to Spitsbergen, an amazing journey. This was in the 60s. Yeah. And so, you know, to have him as a father-in-law, as mother, and clearly it was always going to be the case that we write books about explorers of the past, I suppose.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Hugh Lewis-Jones, co-author with his wife, Kari Herbert, of Explorers, Sketchbooks, The Art of Discovery and Adventure. Now, one thing I've certainly noticed is that almost all of these sketchbooks are truly sketchbooks. They are drawings, they're paintings, they're...
And some of them beautiful.
Some of them quite well done. Is it a job requirement of an explorer to be a good artist?
there are lots of things, I think, on the job requirement. You've got to be stubborn, you've got to be curious, you've got to be flexible. Most of these explorers, you know, yes, they were pretty talented artists, because if you think... You know, long before film and long before photography and kind of modern day means of recording the world, these explorers, if they're going into an unknown place or a little known place, really their journals, their sketchbooks, the images that they can create are the ways and means of recording their achievements. How else can they prove it back at home, these wonderful things that they've seen and done, if they're unable to accurately record these things in their journals? Many of these explorers, I mentioned Captain Cook, he takes a whole bunch of artists on his voyages and many others after him. So one of Captain Cook's artists, William Hodges, is here in the book. Behold the world's first watercolors of icebergs. Doesn't sound that impressive, but it's incredible to think, you know, there's this moment when they're seeing Antarctic icebergs for the very first time. And he's reaching for his watercolors. His fingers are freezing. Perhaps his paints are freezing too.
Yeah.
Unless he's capturing an image that his boss, Captain Cook, wants him to set down and set down for posterity.
Now, are there photographs included of the later?
Yeah, there are. I mean, yes, there are some photographs. I mean, I'm well known, if I'm well known at all in England, for the photography and exploration books that we make. But of course, as the years progress for these explorers, photography increasingly becomes the means of recording discoveries on expeditions. I think of a man called George Lowe, who was a New Zealand climber. He, in fact, was one of two New Zealanders on the Everest expedition in 1953, the more famous Ed Hillary, you know, at a time probably the most famous man in the world, the first up Everest. But his best friend, George Lowe, was a photographer on that expedition. And he later then went on the first crossing of Antarctica as the official photographer. This is in the 50s. And so his journal in the book is filled with sketches too, but also little photographs that he would develop in film in a dark room that he built himself in their hut, carrying his developing fluids in a thermos flask right across the continent. And his journal is filled with little images to remind him of what they've done and to set the sequence of their story for the books they'd have to write when they got home, you know.
Oh, wow. Well, Would you like to read a passage from one of the... And actually, I'd like you to read about your father-in-law.
Hey, oh, this is surprising. Have I got time to pull up the book off the shelf and get it down?
Oh, sure, sure.
Father-in-law, late father-in-law Sir Wally Herbert, passed away over 10 years ago now. And as I said, he's well-known in England, but I guess he really his achievements have been not ignored so much as you know, his expedition in the 60s was, you know, crossing the top of the world, the first to cross the Arctic Ocean with dogs and sledges, is just at the same time when man is looking skyward into space and stepping for the first time on the moon. So Wally's achievements were almost immediately cast into the shadow of that great achievement, the NASA Apollo missions. I've bought myself some time to grab the book. What would you like me to read?
Well, actually, I thought, you know, reading about him might be interesting, but whatever you'd like would be great.
Well, the thing with Wally, and I can read, I open the book, and let me describe what I see, and
okay.
I can see his journals from actually the 1950s in Antarctica. So he's sketching glaciers, glaciers that his heroes, Captain Scott and Shackleton and the rest, had traveled up 50 years before him, but not taken the time to chart accurately. And so Wally had the privilege of following in their footsteps. I turn the page again, and it's full of his own drawings of time amongst the ice. He writes that a pioneer has an unspoken responsibility to bring back something of value from his travels, whether it's a map or a discovery, some specialist knowledge perhaps, and contribute to the understanding of our planet. And I think that's a fairly good sort of message for what is an explorer. And there are lots of ways to explore and to discover, and all of these things are still going on now in different ways. But it's all about bringing back some value and understanding. And whether that's, you know, encouraging people to appreciate more of this beautiful planet or as much as a great scientific discovery, I think that's a fair element of what it means to be an explorer. Can I share a thought with you from an explorer who's not in the book?
Of course.
Because I was speaking to someone earlier today, and it reminded me that today in America is John Muir Day, the 21st of April, the anniversary of his birth. If you don't know John Muir, he's a sort of a pioneer conservationist, wilderness advocate, an explorer who helped set up some of the first American national parks, a man who really deserved to be in this book, and maybe will be in my next one. But this today is his day, and his journals are full of beautiful writing as much as very interesting sketching. And when I travel in the wilderness or travel to the polar regions, I often read some of his work because I share some of his feelings for our planet, this wonderful world that is big, and one wants to have a good look at it before it gets dark. When the mountains are calling, you must get going. In the wilderness, as he wrote, lies the hope of the world. So this idea that actually explorers and traveling to remote places is good for us as much as good for everyone that we can share these stories with too, and reminds us at every single step, and I would hope at every turn of the page in a book like this, that we're living in a truly wonderful planet, and we shouldn't take that for granted.
That's true.
One of the things I love about the book is that for each explorer, you have a quote from that explorer. And I love reading quotes anyway, but I like some of these a lot. Vivian Fox. There's a real
Fuchs, that's right.
Fuchs. Yeah, there's a real difference between travelers and explorers. Travelers go to places, whereas explorers go to acquire knowledge. They travel for a purpose. Many of these, you did include a lot of women explorers. I didn't realize there were so many.
I would say not enough. my wife was very good at reminding me every step we should have as many women as men, but there really are some truly intrepid women. I mean, that should be no surprise to people, but their histories, their stories are often neglected. But, you know, many of these women, I think of archaeologists like Adela Breton or Margaret Fontaine or Margaret Mee, who, you know, devoted her life to painting beautiful flowers in deep jungles and various things. And these women were not only doing all the tough things that explorers were doing, and then some, but also breaking boundaries in terms of the societies in which they lived, and they were pathfinding in so many ways. So definitely, their stories deserve to be told more widely. I think of it's a rather sad note. Someone like Alexandrine Tinner, who tried to be the first woman to cross the Sahara to get to the source of the Nile too, and her journals have to survive her. She's ambushed on a journey and robbed and essentially left to die in the desert, which is obviously awful, but thank goodness her letters and her journals survive her. So, you know, her explorations weren't in vain, and the same sort of applies to many of these explorers. This is why they were trying so hard to leave an account of their travels. What they were doing was dangerous, tough, difficult, in very testing circumstances, but they believed strongly in what they were doing, and hoping that those little pictures in their journals and beautiful watercolor paintings that took them so long to achieve would be appreciated by others if they didn't manage to make it home.
Tell us a little bit about Gertrude Bell. I was not familiar with her, and I was amazed at her story.
Yeah, I mean, Gertrude Bell, another sort of one of these wonderful, intrepid explorers. I mean, in the book, we just devote a handful of pages, really, to her sketches. She's an archaeologist. She travels to Persia, essentially. She's a climber, too, a poet, a writer, a linguist, a political spy, a kingmaker, if you like. She's working at the time, you know, sort of in the run-up to the First World War, when there's a lot of geopolitics going on in the Near East, Middle East. But she's, you know, collecting and filling her journals as others might, you know, collect butterflies or plants. She's collecting language and making detailed drawings of Syrian architecture or temple floor plans or local heritage and customs, fragments of pottery, you know, all manner of things that catch her eye. And there are many other women like it. You know, perhaps we should do a book next time just on women travellers. But I think one of the pleasures in me for us in creating this was actually letting women have lots of space alongside all of these other famous British and American explorers that maybe we know so much about. You know, it's quite good that they're all in the same book together. And this alphabetic treatment that you've talked about, you know, gives everyone due space, you know, due time. Yes. Everyone, there's no hierarchy here. Everyone is kind of treated equally. And so it's nice. We jump from inside a tent in a snowstorm to turn the page and join a bunch of crazy Norwegians crossing the Pacific on a balsa wood raft. Turn the page and we're climbing Everest again. Turn the page once more and we're deep in an Egyptian room. Turn a page and we're, you know, collecting butterflies.
And every page is so beautiful.
It's all there.
So did you do both, and I'm wondering how the division of labor between you and Carrie was in terms of writing, selecting the quotes, laying things out, deciding what pictures to include. Did you split it up by explorer, or did one of you do all the writing and the other did all the layout, or how did you do that?
Oh, it's very much a team effort. We share an office. We share a writing room, and we actually, we're publishers as well, so we make the books together.
Wow.
As a historian, I'm kind of more used to gathering and creating exhibitions and working with visuals and art directing, but Kari does the same too. So for a book like this, we'll, after a year or two, whittle down our wish list into something that's manageable, and a few more years of research and curation helps us identify the things that we can photograph and have photographed and be brought into the sort of public domain, if you like. And then we set about the task of writing, and you know, we each wrote about those explorers who, you know, captured our interest. We fought over a few, I suppose. You probably wrote more of the ladies. I probably wrote more of the beardy polar explorers and mountaineers. And then we would help edit each other's work. As for the picture edit, you know, she's not here, so she can't disagree with me. I probably did the lion's share of it. Has a great eye for these kind of things. And then, of course, we work with a great publisher, in fact, a number of publishers. So this book has been published in a bunch of languages in England. It's Thames and Hudson in America. It's a publisher called Chronicle, who also have a lovely design team. So there's a whole range of talents that make us look much better than we are. But
this was obviously a labor of years.
I would say, say a labor of love. I mean, books like this.
A labor of love, but that took many years, yeah.
I would challenge any author. I don't know any, I know lots of authors. I don't know any that are writing about things that they don't love or find interesting. I can't see the point in devoting many years of your life to writing about stuff that really doesn't capture your interest. And you sort of hope that that comes across in the page, and then you celebrate a book that comes out, and you move immediately on to the next one.
I'm sorry I have to cut you off, because this book is wonderful and you're so interesting to talk to, but we're out of time. And I know. And so with your next book, we're going to get you on for a full hour, because we need more time.
That's very kind of you. I would suggest actually you just get my wife on. She'll be far.
Oh, I don't know. Anyway.
So, so thank you very much. And if you're listening on Friday, stay tuned for Planet Earth Wild. We rebroadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m. We'll also post this podcast on writersvoices.com. And, Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
Well, I do. This is from the book, actually. It's a quote from Charles Evans, who, of course, was in his Everest journals. Mm-hmm. And it says, "Many men are happier and find it less strain to fight against wind and wet, cold and fatigue, other than against telephones and timetables."
And if you're ready for an exploration, highly recommend the Explorer's Sketchbook. And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available.